Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Now Where Were We? Bob Cryer here, and this is the second part of the chat that Dad and I had with the Swiss Army knife of the entertainment industry, Joe Brown. There's obviously a part one, and if you'd like to listen to that first, well, be my guest. However, if you'd prefer to carry on and hear all about the Linton Brothers' slow motion fight routine, then let's crack on.
It's quite amazing. I remember working with a couple of guys called the Linton Brothers.
Were they twins?
No, I think it was father and son. It was either a pantomime or a variety show. It might have been a pantomime, and it was in Hull. And these guys, their dressing room was about four floors up or something, and one of them, they couldn't make it up the stairs, so they did their little spot. They'd done about a 6-7 minute spot, and then they had to sit downstairs because he couldn't get up the stairs. But their spot was absolutely incredible. Did you ever see him do the slow motion fight?
No.
Oh, amazing. One of them would come at him with a dagger. And he'd go to stab him, and the bloke would hit him, and he'd fall back like that, and the dagger used to fall gently down to the ground. And then he'd go roll over, and all in slow motion.
Brilliant.
And at the end of the fight, he'd pull a gun out. And the gun had a little bowl squeezy thing with talcum powder in it. And at the end of the gun, which you couldn't see, there was a ring. And this ring was attached to a piece of fishing line. So he'd hook his finger in the fishing line, which you couldn't see, and pull it towards his chest. And as the fishing line came out, then the bullet came out after it. And then after that, a puff of smoke.
Brilliant.
And it'd smack it and hit him in the chest, and the drummer would crack like that, and they go down on the ground. This act, man, it was so precise.
Yeah.
I was trying to find out if there was any videos of it, but there isn't.
Well, it's like you were saying about Tommy Cooper. Everything was meticulously put together.
Everything was slow motion, and when they fell down.
That's brilliant.
Absolutely. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah. You know,
there was other things that they did amongst that, apart from the bullet and the knife. But apart from that, I mean, it's just a fallacy.
It's one of the great fallacies about music and about comedy and things that these, you know, if you're sort of a natural comedian, you're a sort of gifted musician, that you somehow just rock up on the night and just do it.
Yeah.
There's so much hard work that goes into it. It's like you were saying about Glenda Jackson, wasn't it, working with Morecambe and Wise?
Yes.
I knew a guy called Serge Gangio.
Oh, boy.
Serge Gangio and his brothers and wife or something did this amazing Russian acrobat act.
Yeah, they're acrobats, weren't they? Yeah.
They used to throw this woman like 15 foot into the air and catcher and all that. It's all moving around. It's just the most amazing kind of detailed act.
Can you see spectacles like that now? We're robbed of that. I suppose it's still going on in Europe somewhere else, but nothing on television.
Simon Cowell would claim that's what Britain's Got Talent is all about, but
yes,
variety repackaged in a different way. But maybe we'll save that for another.
What Joe was saying about the slow motion, I mean, that is just brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, that would still be quite a sensation if you saw it now current generation. It's
that was
brilliant.
Funny, clever when you saw it happen and when that bullet come out of the gun.
Yeah.
Yes.
He only just took his finger and pulled it and it was just the bullet would come out.
The Linton.
Every detail.
Is it the Linton brothers?
The Linton boys.
The Linton boys.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully you're all Googling at home that. See if we can find
Google
someone.
It. Yeah. The only thing I could find was they were on a show with Max Bygraves. That's all I got. No other details about them at all, you know. Maybe the Walter Rats would know.
Yes, that's true.
There's no visual on the
And
lintel.
So our next stop is Max Bygraves. Who has a story about Max Bygraves?
I got a story about Max Bygraves.
I've got one or two, I won't tell you.
Well, he suddenly decided to make a rock and roll record. So he got me to produce a record. So I got all the band in and got them to lay the track down, and he came in. It wasn't a very good record, actually.
What was it called, Joe?
I don't know. I can't remember what it was called. But, I mean, he shouldn't have been doing it. Let's put it like that.
He did a song called Deck of Cards, and Eric and Ernie did a sketch. And in the middle of this sketch, Ernie said, "That's the most frightening thing I've ever heard." And Eric said, "Have you heard Max singing Deck of Cards?" They got a very angry letter from Max.
Oh, really?
Who then displayed his hit records on Sunday night at the Palladium. This is as opposed to Des O'Connor, who loved being on with them. And Eric said, "Des gives us jokes to do about him." That was the difference of the two things. And years ago, it may have been a one-off for the end of the series, I worked on a series with Max at Thames Television, together with Spike Mullins, the brilliant man who wrote Ronnie Corbett in the Chair, and the great Dick Vosborough. The three of us were there, and Max had broken the embargo and gone to South Africa during apartheid to appear at Sun City and all that. And he's talking about South Africa in the bar. And Max said, "I don't know what they're on about with apartheid. It works." And Spike Mullins said, "I've heard enough of this crap. I'm going for a piss." And me and Dick Vosper got up, solidarity, and the three of us walked out on the Star, leaving him there alone.
Well, Spike Mullins, I mean, this Spike Mullins, he was a fabulous guy. He lived in Slough, right?
That's right.
And he once asked me round for dinner because he was working on one of my shows. And he wrote some great, funny stuff.
Oh, God, he's brilliant.
What was the one he wrote? Never forget when I met Paul Blindell in a gaming club just outside Strood. At the end of the evening, the stakes could be high. You see, we were gambling for food. I'll never forget when I met Paul Blindell. 'Twas a night I've never forgotten. I won a whole box of fish on the turn of a card, and the ones in the middle were rotten. And this monologue went on forever. Yeah, all of a sudden, out from the crowd steps a man from Albuquerque, and with a crushing blow, I laid him low with the corpse of a frozen turkey. We awoke in the bed with a pain in my head and the turkey stretched out on the other. Said a nurse with a smile, "You'll be all right in a while, but we couldn't save your brother." And anyway, I used to go to his house, and him and his wife, they run a double act between them.
Yeah.
She come in, she say, put the food down and say, "I made this myself." And Spike would say, "Of course you did. I wouldn't sell that in a shop."
Mary Mullins, wasn't it?
And they went through all this whole routine. I said, "Why do you live in this awful place?" He said, "It's the only inspiration I can get."
Yeah. The first time I met Spike, what Joe was saying where he lived, and he got two trains to come in to the rehearsal, whatever, you know, change trains and everything. And I said, "How long did it take you to get here today, Spike?" He said, "About an hour and 45. Long time without a woman." I thought, does he never switch off? And then one day we were auditioning a young comic. It was like Britain's Got Talent, but we were really auditioning this young comic. Spike and I are sitting there, and bless his heart, this young guy, and oh dear, the actor were getting a bit embarrassed. And then he finished it, and it wasn't a sort of finish. And he looked at Spike and said, "How could I finish the act?" And Spike said, "Throw money at the audience and escape in the ensuing confusion." But he'd been a plasterer or something, Joe, hadn't he, who submitted jokes.
He's just one of them funny. I mean, when you looked at him, it's very weird with people like that. I've noticed this. Who's the guy that did Dad's Army?
Arthur Lowe. Of course, Mannering, yes.
I was doing a thing a big charity thing one day, and there was loads of people on it, and we was all sharing this big dressing room, and Arthur Lowe walked into the dressing room, and it's just his mere presence. Everyone was piddling themselves laughing.
Yeah.
He was just a funny kind of guy, yeah, you know.
But then,
yeah. But talking about people that can't do it, you'll love this, Jess Conrad.
Yes.
Now, Jess has made a fortune out of being useless. And if he hears this, he'll love it, because as long as you mention his name,
oh, yes, that's right.
He's happy. So anyway, so we was at the Water Rats ball once, me and my late missus, and as you go in, there's a big bank of photographers, and you're there in your tails and whatever, and they're all taking pictures. And I go in with my wife. Oh, hold on, Joe, just stand there a minute. So I'm stood there with my wife. And next thing I know, and I look, it's Jess Conrad between us, you know, having his picture taken. And every time he saw a camera go, he'd be over there. Right. And I saw him about a couple of hours into the evening. He was standing on this big staircase at Grosvenor House, curved stairway, and in a pink dinner jacket, just looking round like that, looking for cameras to go off. And I come up alongside him. I said, hello, Jess. And he didn't look at me. He said, oh, hello, Joe. How are you? I said, here. I said, you never believe this. He said, what? I said, I've just been watching Top of the Pops. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I said, I've seen a bloke on Top of the Pops. I said, do you know what? He was a worse singer than you. And he looked straight at me like that, and he said, yeah, come on, don't take that away from me.
Kenny Everett did a LP, as you say in those days, of the worst songs that had been in the charts and everything.
Pull up my
And
pull
Jess
up.
Was thrilled to be included.
But he said to me one day at one of these functions, he said, because he's always very aloof, you know, he says to me, you're a funny bloke, aren't you, Joe? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, I'm short of stuff, to one-liners and stuff for my act. So I said, oh, he said, well, especially the opening. I said, oh, I said, perhaps I can help you out. Oh, if you could, I'd be very grateful. I said, well, what do you want to do, mate? I says, is the band play you on? Don't, oh, yes, the band play me on, of course. I said, when you get to the mic, I said, don't stop and talk to the audience. Go straight into your first song. Oh, I do that anyway. I said, well, then you're halfway there. Halfway there.
Yeah.
What do you mean? I said, well, all you have to do, when you finish the song, just step forward to the microphone and say, if you thought that was bad, you wait till you hear me sing MacArthur Park.
What about you and Simon Dean?
Oh,
Joe?
I was just going to come on to that. Because
rude
that,
interruption. I apologise.
No, but that Des O'Connor story that you told about taking himself too seriously in the way Max Bygraves did with Morecambe and Wise.
Yes.
That links in very well with that story that Dad tells about you being on the Simon D show.
Simon D, yes, years ago, whose ego took over. What a fall was there. But he interviewed you, didn't he?
Simon D. Probably.
Yeah, but he said something, a rather rude line to you. Are we going to hear your indifferent single or something?
I don't remember.
A very rude. And
well, the way you always tell it, yeah, is that everyone who knew you would have said you would have had a million different comebacks. And instead, you just
pause and said, yeah. And the audience went, ah, they were with you from that moment, Joe. You could have killed him with a line.
You learn
at that
a
moment.
Lot from these people. I mean, dear old Anna Neagle, I mean, she was at this dinner and doing this little speech at the dinner, thanking them and all this business. And some guy shouted something out, which was quite complimentary, I think. And Anna just stopped speaking and said, I'm so sorry, I didn't hear you. Would you mind repeating that?
Yes.
That was it. Finished.
Very good.
Finished.
Vincent Price, the great Vincent Price, pick the names as they thud. He was interviewed by Simon D, and Vincent told an anecdote, and it wasn't maybe one of his best. It got a sort of laugh from the audience, and Simon D said, oh, boy, that went well. I think we need a song here. And he turned to the band. He said, have you got my number? And Vincent Price said, we've all got your number, darling.
I remember him now. I don't take any notice of these people. I mean, they're not worth... They really show themselves up when they do something like that.
The directors used to do things like shooting the top of his head when he was interviewing people. He'd got no respect. He'd left the BBC. He and his agent, the exotically known Bunny Lewis, Bill Cotton at the BBC, they went to see Bill Cotton.
So Bill.
We've had an offer from, you know, London Weekend or whatever. And Bill, it was a lovely move. He said, well, there you are. He said, well, I'll tell you what. I want to know what you think of the BBC. So if you decide to stay here at exactly the same money, it'll show your respect for the BBC. And they didn't. They went to ITV. And what happened? What a fall was there. And I didn't think Jack D was old enough, but Jack used to love me referring to him as Simon.
So was this old Bill or young Bill?
This is young Bill.
Oh, yeah. I knew
Bill
old
Cotton
Bill.
Junior.
I know, yeah.
And went to...
Because your first job on television, was old Bill?
Old Bill
then?
And I were great friends.
Yeah.
Because we used to do the Billy Cotton Band Show all the time.
Yes.
You know, and we used to do the Billy Cotton Band Show at... Charing Cross, I think it was. And then one time we were doing it, and it wasn't at Charing Cross because there was something had happened there. There was a fire or they were decorating the studio, something like that. And so they moved us to the Aeolian Hall. So where we did the show, the Saturday Club. So when I come out in the corridor, it's 10 to 1. And Billy Cotton starts at 1 o'clock, right? Dead on, live. As I come out in the corridor, old Bill's there. Hello, Joey. He said, what are you doing here? I said, I just done Saturday Club. What are you doing? I said, no, I've had some problem. Oh, he said, you got the boys with you? I said, yeah, of course I have. He said, come on in. He said, we'll do some songs. I said, but Bill, I said, it's like 10 to 1 now or something. Come on, you come in. Because Bill was the big wheel,
yes.
You know, BBC, old Bill, you know.
Yeah.
So we go in the bloody studio and he calls up to young Bill, who's producing the show, in a box, as a sound box, which is right up this set of stairs. Billy, he says, he comes back, yes, Dad. He said, Joey's here with the boys. He said, we're going to cut Breezy's number and Joey's going to do a couple of songs. You can't do that, Dad. It's now 5 to 1. You can't do that, Dad. He said, it's 5 to 1. We'll go up in 5 minutes. Come down here. And he got him down and he stood here and I stood next to him and Billy Junior stayed there and the whole orchestra was there. And old Billy said to him, the trouble with you, son, he said, you ain't got no balls. This boy here, he pats me on the shoulder, has got more bollocks in his little finger than you'll ever have in your old body. I'm just stood there.
Bill Jr.
Well, the BBC never used me for 6 years after.
Really?
Because, well, he became the bloody like entertainment, didn't he?
Yeah.
Wouldn't have anything to do with me. But Billy was like that. Old Bill was like that. He did.
You talk to me like that, don't you? Often.
Very similar.
Well, old Bill was a great bloke. He used to drive racing cars and all that.
Yes.
He was a real 100% geezer, you know, old Billy.
Bill
Jr.
Because
he was bloody useless. I mean, you know, he knew nothing about music and you wouldn't get one of them boys in the orchestra to knock him for it. Because I said, no, he's not really a musician, but he's got a good ear.
Yeah.
And they'd all praise him up. He was loved, you know, great man.
Bill Jr. speaking at a lunch and Vera Lynn and Harry, her husband, were there. And Bill mentioned Vera at one point and he said, oh, at one point you left, didn't you, Vera? Got the sack, she said very loudly to him.
Who was this?
Vera Lynn.
Oh, Vera.
And she guested on a Morgan and Wise show. And John Junkin and I were writing for Eric and Ernie then. And I used to irritate John by referring to Eddie Braben as the A-team. I thought, Eddie Braben, what a man, you know, turn them into Eric and Ernie and everything. And John Junkin came up with the idea that Eric liked. He said, it'd be funny if Vera comes on and doesn't know we want her to sing. So, right, so it worked a treat. Ernie, very effusively, Vera Lynn, enormous applause. And she came on and he said, what are you going to sing for us, Vera? And she said, sorry? What are you going to sing for us? Oh, I didn't know you wanted me to sing, she said. I thought I was just a guest. Oh, boy, cut to Eric Morecambe on another camera. Come here, sunshine. Ernie comes over. What's the problem? Vera doesn't know we want her to sing. What can we do? And Eric said, short of starting another war, I've no idea.
Yeah, there was all them lovely gags, weren't there?
Yeah, Don Black did another gag. He said the Second World War was started by Vera Lynn's agent.
Yeah, someone said he knew the Falklands War was about to start because he said he walked past Vera Lynn's house and he could hear her rehearsing with a band. Them gags.
But who said that?
I can't remember who said it.
Doddy said he knew trouble was brewing because he walked past and heard Vera Lynn gargling. Now, I thought that's brilliant. Not doing scales, gargling.
Isn't it amazing where these things come from? Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Oh, boy.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Well, you know, Barry is telling you this because I need to know. I've heard people say there's only 7 jokes.
Yeah, they're all on a formula.
And you've heard all of them this afternoon.
Yeah, and don't analyse comedy. That's like dissecting a frog. Nobody laughs and the frog dies. That was E.B. White or somebody.
E.B. White, Charlotte's Web. Who came up with that?
No joke. People have said to me more than once, I told one of your jokes last night. I say, you're welcome. I didn't write them. They're common property. Don't nick material. That's different. But no, jokes. You're welcome. I heard them like you heard them. You're welcome.
It's a program about telling jokes. And give me any subject and I'll tell you a joke about it. Right, so Vickers. So then you say, well, I knew this vicar who had a dog, and now you're talking about dogs.
Yes.
So, I mean, right.
Oh, funny you should say that.
You've never been known to segue like that, Dad, have you?
A woman bought 2 parrots, and she was told male and female. And she said to the man, how will I ever know the difference? He said, well, to put it delicately, they probably start mating, and the one on top is the male. Oh, right. So one day she looked in the cage and she gently took the parrot that was on top and thought, that's the male. But how will I know in future which is which? Ah, she got some white thread and tied it very gently round the parrot's neck. So the parrot now had this white thing round its neck. And one day the vicar came to tea and was sitting in the armchair with his white collar on. And the parrot looked across and said, I see she caught you at it as well. That links
so
up
funny.
With Vicar there.
I know. So I remember once someone said, who writes these jokes? And they said, prisoners.
Yes, good point. Where do they come from? We're fascinated by this.
They evolve.
But yes, you know, the great thing is, is observing people. If you're in a pub,
yes.
You know, I mean, there was a thing I noticed the other day where it was just so funny. To me, it was funny where there was a bloke with his missus and I'm telling someone this story, he said, well, me and the missus, we was walking down the street and she said the street. He said, this van pulled up. She's repeating everything he said. These two geezers got out. And one of them was a great big fella, and they're kind of repeating it all the time.
Yes.
I thought, I've seen this before. You know, it's so funny. And there was one guy, my bloody car broke down and we was in this pub waiting for the AA to come. And there was these two blokes talking at the bar. And one of them said, Well, he said, I turned round to him and I said, da 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 da. And he turned round to me and said, well, just up. So I turned round to him and he went, well, and then he turned round to me and says, and then I turned round and thought, I just thought that was hilarious.
Yes, yeah.
You know, he turned around and thought. I see. He didn't turn around and say anything. You know?
My theory about the origin of jokes is, I think, at some point somebody mentioned something in real life and some bright spark said it'd be funnier if that was in Paris, or it'd be funnier if she'd said it, not him. And somewhere along the line, this little story gets concocted by, you know, that'd be funnier if. There we are. Wasn't that interesting? Thank you. Anyway, this old lady with the Bible.
That's it. Yeah. There you go.
Could you bear it, Joe? I'll put it in context. I was in Sheiky's restaurant, Leicester Square, years ago.
Very expensive, but indeed. Sell jelly deals.
Yes, I was being treated. And John Mortimer, who I knew, he was now in a wheelchair, bless him, and he gave me a wave and I went over. And we chatted and then he said, come on, choke. And it flooded back to me the other day, what I told him. This man's sitting opposite a sweet old lady on the train, and the train leaves the station and she takes a Bible out of her bag and reads from it silently. The train gets to the next station. Oh, Bible back in the bag. He's looking. Train sets off again. Out comes the Bible. Next station, Bible back in the bag. He's now riveted. And it happens a third time and he can't bear it. And he said, do excuse me. And she said, yes. He said, every time the train leaves the station, you take your Bible out and read from it. Yes, yes, I do, yes. When the train gets to the next station, you put the Bible back in your bag. Yes, yes. And this happens every time. Yes. Do forgive me, why are you doing this? And she said, why don't you fuck off?
It's great, isn't it?
And I told that to Penelope recently, John's widow, and she said, I'm telling everybody. On the day, I raised my voice like, this is in a restaurant.
Oh,
can
Sheiky's,
you imagine the people at the next the people at the next table who's telling John Mortimer to fuck off? He wiped his eyes. He said, this has made my day. Yes, I was sharing that with everybody, sharing it with Joe
and
everybody.
Yeah, it was my birthday present.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I should let him use it.
Michael Palin couldn't stop when I rang Mike Palin and the old lady said, well, are you fine? I just heard noises at the other end. He said, oh, I'll be back in a minute, Ben.
He's funny, Michael Palin.
Oh, God.
He's a lovely guy. I mean, I've seen him a couple of times. I saw him. I used to see him at George Harrison's because he was a friend of George's. And I also saw him at the Chelsea Arts Club. But my missus said to me, I mean, she's always on the television about, you know, contribute to the donkeys or to the Himalayas. She's always paying out for this. And so she says she's found this advert for a goat. If you buy a goat, it goes to this village. And it was him advertising the thing, Michael. And then they send you pictures of the goat and all that. And then you just pay every week for the goat, see? So I saw him around at George's and I don't know if he'd forgotten about it, but I said to him, oi, he said, yeah, what? I said, where's my goat? He said, I beg your pardon? I said, my goat. We pay for a goat. You told us we had to buy this goat and we get pictures. I haven't seen no pictures. Where's the goat? And he sort of like that, and I saw him again. I said, have you heard about my goat? I kept on to him, and he never got it. And finally, he realised that it was because he'd done this bloody thing on there, you know.
Yeah.
And he pissed himself laughing when I told him.
The night I was heckled, here he goes, Danny LaRue's club, which was amazing in those days, Hanover Square, and the people who came, it's just amazing. And I was writing them, and I was in it, and I'd do the warm-up. We'd have an opening song, and then I'd go on, do some jokes, and then the show would really get going. And I told a joke this particular night, and the voice in the darkness said, this is satire, I suppose. And I said, no, it's nightclub filth. You should get out more. He's got a laugh. John Lennon. I was heckled by John Lennon.
I read in your book, yeah.
A year or two later, he's now with Yoko. And I'm working, one of the gang working and writing with David Frost. And there's John and Yoko. And he peered at me and he said, "Do I know you?" I said, "Danny LaRue's Club." He said, "Oh my God, I was off me head." So I didn't remind him. I didn't say, "And you heckled me one night, didn't you?"
But he did apologise to you, yeah. Didn't he?
Oh.
Yeah, I mean,
this is your support act, though, of course, going way back.
Yeah, it was very strange, that, because the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein.
Brian Epstein.
Well, Brian had got in touch with my manager and said that the boys had been doing great in all the Liverpool clubs, like the Cavern and all that round there, but he wanted them to appear in front of a bigger audience, a different audience. So they booked the boys to support me on a couple of shows in Liverpool. And the funny thing was, they were great. They were great. But what struck me as very strange is that Brian Epstein wheeled them into my dressing room like I was some enormous star and lined them up there and introduced them all. And they all sort of shook hands and bowed and all that. And he introduced Paul as the leader of the Beatles, right?
Interesting. Yeah.
Which was, it was interesting because I didn't know. Anyway, as soon as I'd heard them play and that, you know, I thought, well, there's something going on here, because they were great. I mean, I knew they was different because they were some of the songs in their act. I'll never forget, one of the songs was Besame Mucho. Besame Mucho. Great song. And I thought, they're supposed to be a rock and roll group.
Yeah.
But they've done all this crap in Germany in the Star Club and all that for years, you know. And they'd obviously learnt their trade, well learnt their trade. Their repertoire was absolutely immense. Anyway, that was in 62. And at the end of 62, of course, they'd taken off and it was worldwide, you know, and I never saw any of them for years and years and years. And then I moved into Henley-on-Thames and I got a call and a voice. This is typical of the man. He's such a lovely guy. "Is that Taylor or is that Joe Brown?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You may not remember me." He said,
"Same thing." Yeah.
"This is George Harrison." Yeah. You know, yeah. And you may not remember. What a great, and of course, I've become great friends with him. And some of the stories, he was a very funny guy.
Well, I was about to say, is that what marked them out at the time when they were first?
I don't know.
Out?
He was very quiet.
Kind of wit.
But he had this wicked sense of humour. Yeah.
They sang in their own voices. They didn't have phony, like you, Joe. You're singing your own voice.
I sang in American accent. My early stuff was Cockney, yeah.
Yeah.
But then I went over the other side. I shouldn't have done it. I mean, we should have been more natural. That was what was great with them. But they were very clever. George was a very, very funny guy. He had that dry Liverpool.
Well, that's what links in. I thought you were going to say about Michael Palin, because he helped produce Python stuff, and he was a big supporter of theirs.
He was of the same ilk, really.
Yeah.
But I remember one time I was over at George's, and we'd been in the studio all day recording stuff, and come about 3 o'clock in the morning, he says to me, "Do you like Indian music?" I thought, oh no, here we go. Bloody Ravi Shankar until 6 o'clock in the morning. So I said, "I don't think I can stand it right now, George." He said, "Oh," he said, "you've got to hear this. You're a musician. You've got to hear this." I said, "All right, what is it?" He said, "It's this Indian bloke," he said, "and he's playing this tune." I said, "Yeah." He said, "And the reason you'll be interested is it's because it's in 9/2 time." I said, "Oh." And he had a disc, you know, and he put the disc on the thing and he got the needle and he put it on there. And a voice went 1-2, 2-2, 3-2, 4-2, 5-2, 6-2, 7-2, 8-2, 9-2. And he took the needle up and said, "Would you like to hear it again?" He's just a funny guy.
Poor drummers have to take. You know this. Musos do jokes, and it's always the drummer who's the butt of the joke. And I heard this one. I think a drummer told me it. And he said, "This poor guy's losing his timing. It's getting to him. People say, 'You've lost your timing. You've lost your timing.'" And in despair, he threw himself behind a train.
Yeah. Yes. Well, those sort of drummer jokes. I mean,
no, we'll be here all day.
All night.
Well, maybe if you're talking about timing, then maybe it's the time to dust off the anecdote perhaps you're most well associated with, and that's Johnny Cash. When people always ask you, oh, when you used to play with Johnny Cash.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, you see, well, I got a big break, probably the best break in the world. I was a guitar player, an electric guitar player, and Jack Good booked me to play on what was to be the new Oh Boy show, which was called Boy Meets Girls. And I couldn't read a note of music, so the Americans used to have to send their records over, and I'd have to learn the solos and the guitar part for the record. And the first guy I get is Johnny Cash. So he sends this record over, and all it is, the guitar part, it's just going, don't think, don't think, don't. That's all it was, don't think, don't think. And then it went up a, don't think, then it went up a tone, don't think, don't. It's all the way through, and Johnny's singing his, how high's the water, mama? Don't think, don't think. 4 foot high and rising, think. Don't think, don't think. Then he goes, how high is the water, mama? 5 foot high and right. Don't think, don't. This bloody song went on for about 14 foot. See, so when we got to about 8 foot six, I'd had enough of this. So he's gone, how high is the water, mama? And I went, and he stopped the show. Nobody ever did that. Ever stop the show? Hold it! And the musical director stood and his bet on up, and he looked across at the audience and said, "There'll be no picking there, Joe." And that was it. Oh. I got fired. I got the sack.
Oh boy!
Then and there, as a matter of fact, I was conducted out. He stood and his bet on up, and he went, "Ye out." As I sort of slunk off, the drummer went, vroom. I thought, oh, get, you get you, you bastard. I'll wait outside for you. Anyway, so I'm sitting in the studio afterwards, almost in tears, you know, on one of these rostrums and waiting for someone to come in, like from production, who I could say, look, will you have a word with a musical director? And tell him I'm ever so sorry, I won't do it again. I promise, never. Nobody come in, and after a while, who should come in looking for something for Johnny Cash? So I'm sitting there almost in tears, and he come over and he said, what's the matter, Joe? And I said to him, I've got the sack. You got the sack? What are you going to put in the sack? I said, no, you don't understand. I said, I've been fired. Fired? Fired? What for? I said, I'll bloody tell you what fur, mate. I said, you stopped the show and I got fired. And he said, well, now we'll just have to see about that. And that was it. He had a word, got me my job back. And I thought afterwards, well, yeah, you know, nobody argued with Johnny Cash because he had too many mates on death row. You know what I mean? Folsom Prison. That's the story.
Didn't he send you something?
Send me a lovely pair of cowboy boots, which I've still got.
Brilliant.
Because I got this letter from Her Majesty's Customs. Where was it now? Someplace in London, one of their offices. I had to go down and pick these boots up. And the guy said there'd be some duty to pay. So I opens up this package, and there's two most beautiful cowboy boots, all different leathers and colours, absolutely amazing. And I think they cost him about 800 quid or something in those days, in 1959. And the guy, and as I'm looking at him, I heard this little voice go by my ear, better be 40 quid duty. I said to him, what? Sorry, son, he said, there's how much you got to pay. I said, I can't afford that, you know. Where we get that sort of money? He said, well, it's pretty. He says, let's have a look at them. He says, put them on. So as I'm putting them on, I'm thinking, I hope they don't fit me. I put these boots on, and he said, oh, they're very nice. He said, have a walk about a bit. So I'm walking around this guy's office, and he says, they'll make you lean forward a bit, don't they? I said, well, you know, the cowboy. He said, oh, he said, very nice. They look great. He said, go over there under the light. He said, never shuffle about over there. So I go and shop him. I said, it's all right. He said, don't get too used to them. Take them off. I took them off. He said, one pair of second-hand boots, give us £3.
You should have been an impressionist, George. Your Johnny Cash was brilliant.
You never forget that, do you, really? Hey, Joe.
No.
That's the story, anyway.
Great.
Before we bring this series to a close, I'd like to repeat my thoughts from the Giles Brandreth episode, thanking everyone that has been in touch with messages of love and support to me and my family. It's a testament to the mark that Dad made on so many lives, that the people doing so have been eclectic and the message unanimous. He had a gift for putting people at their ease and for making them laugh. A lot. Thanks also to those of you who've donated to the two charities we've appointed to remember him with, the Royal Variety Charity and Macmillan. Links to both are available on Dad's Twitter page, at BarryCryer80. And although this is the end of the journey for these conversations, a special episode of tributes to Dad from some of the people we wanted to speak to is already in the works. So look out for that in the coming weeks. Please like, review, and tell your friends so they don't miss out on that one. He may no longer be with us, but the stories, the jokes, the memories, all the silliness, in fact, including that laugh, will bring a smile to our faces for many, many years to come. To end, though, we thought it would be appropriate to let Dad and Joe sum up how this series has left most of us feeling.
Yeah. Joe, it's been a pleasure. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Barry, we could spend hours doing this.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.